Atheist Nomads, episode 317, Healthcare for Trans People with Callie Wright.
The podcast you're about to listen to includes cursing and talking about hoo-haws. Please be advised.
Welcome to another episode of Atheist Nomads. I am Dustin, and joining me here in a little bit will be Callie Wright from Queersplaining. So, I do want to cover a little bit of news before we get to that. And also, don't forget that we have got the Camp Nomad coming up in just a couple weeks. It'll be September 13 to 15 in Island Park, Idaho. So if you want to check that out, head over to the website, atheistnomads.com/camp. Take a look at the details and then reach out to us using the feedback form or shoot us an email at contact@atheistnomads.com to RSV your spot. Because, as I've already said before, not all those who wander are lost, but if you don't have the address, you definitely will be. So definitely, yeah, we'd love to have as many of you as possible come and join us for that. It's going to be a lot of fun out in the woods, with a creek, at a cabin, in the mountains, with a chance of moose coming around. So it's not something to miss out on. Come check it out. All right, but before we get to the interview, we are mostly taking a break from the news this week. I do want to talk about one relevant story that has come up. The Trump administration is working on a rule to allow for religious litmus tests for federal contractors. So what this would do would be exclude any federal contractor that considers itself to be religious to be exempt from all non-discrimination rules. So that means if you're a federal contractor with owners that are religious, possibly, or in any way associated with any kind of religion, I'm thinking hospitals here, possibly Chick-fil-A, if they have any government contracts, then you can just say, hey, you know what? We don't have to follow all of this. So if you are gay, trans, an atheist, possibly even just not a white Protestant Christian, you're out. Granted, Catholic hospitals wouldn't be going for just white Protestants. They'd probably prefer Catholics, regardless of race. But yeah, gays, trans people, people who are, you know, single moms, people who are living with somebody they aren't married to, atheists, we would all be potentially screwed over from a decent amount of jobs that are out on the market that are being funded by the government. This is really bad. This is something that definitely needs to stop. It is a rule that the Department of Labor is considering, and it is up for public comment. So you should comment on this. This is something we could try to stop. Granted, I don't think we necessarily would be able to stop it, but we should try. Because I'm sure the religious people are going to be commenting plenty, saying that this is good. If our taxpayer dollars are going towards a government contractor, they shouldn't be able to discriminate no matter what. That is government money funding that. And yeah, that discrimination needs to stop. This is a big part of the right wing's attempt to try to push things forward, or from our standpoint, push things backwards so that they are exempt from all non-discrimination rules and can be whatever kind of bigot they want to be. And right now, they're mostly just focused on trying to be bigoted assholes to gay and trans people. But if you give them time, they will be coming after atheists and possibly ethnic minorities. So we need this to stop now, period. Fight it best you can. Submit comments and make sure that the word about this is out there, because we should not have this happening. Anyway, that's all I'm going to cover for news today. And we'll probably be covering news next week a bit more, catching up on some of the stuff. But at this point, we'll be right back with Callie Wright from Queersplaining. We are now joined by Callie Wright from Queersplaining. And Callie's been on the show before. Last time was episode 156, which was July 21, 2016. And also previously been on episode 103. So it's been like 160 episodes since you've been on. So welcome back.
Been a while.
Yeah.
Wow. I can't sing. That was terrible. I shouldn't have done that.
Oh, man. So yeah, last time we had you on, we were talking about how the GOP platform in 2016 was going to screw over the LGBT community and bathroom bills.
Yeah. And I believe what that episode proved was my psychic abilities, apparently.
And for our listeners who don't know, Callie is a trans activist, awesome atheist, amazing, wonderful person. Helps run the atheist podcaster group on Facebook, since I hate Facebook.
Oh, I heard that.
And you're awesome.
Aw, yeah. Thanks.
You're one of my favorite people on the internet.
Gosh, thank you. That feels nice. I try really hard. I mean, my whole thing, honestly, is just that, like, the world is such a, like, constantly on fire place now.
Oh, yeah.
That I just feel like if nothing else, I can try to at least make people smile a little bit and bring some measure of joy to people's lives. And so that's a very validating thing to hear, because that is something I deliberately try to do. So thank you.
Yeah. You know, a while back, I did a purge of Facebook friends to try to get it down to just people that I interact with on a regular basis, or preferably know in real life. Mm-hmm. And I discovered that when I did that, I went from wanting to spend about a half hour a week on Facebook to zero.
Yeah.
And you were one of the first people I added back on.
Aw.
So, yeah. seeing your posts is always nice. But anyway, let's before we get into the specific thing I was wanting to talk to you about today, what is it like being a trans person in Trump's America?
Terrifying, to be totally honest. You know, I'm white. I generally am read as a woman by the people, you know, that I run into.
Mm-hmm.
And that both of those things afford me a shield that a lot of other trans folks don't have. And so it's not so much scary for me in a day-to-day, like, I feel like I'm actively in danger while I'm walking down the street sense.
Right.
Although there is some of that, especially given how often I travel, when I'm, you know, in places that where I'm very isolated, you know, and like rest stop bathrooms and that kind of stuff, that gets kind of scary. And that's definitely amped up a little bit. And I can't say for sure whether that's rational or not, but it definitely feels very real in that all of the awful things that have been emboldened under this administration, like anti-queer and anti-trans hate, is definitely one of them. And I definitely feel the weight of that day to day. And my fear now with all of that is, you know, as they roll back all of the non-discrimination protections, mm-hmm. like in the Affordable Care Act and the employment protections that were all just put in place by executive order, right? And like none of this was law. That, you know, I'm going to run into a scenario where, like, I'm going to go to a hospital and need serious health care and run into problems with that, or my wife is, or, you know, and it hasn't escaped me. Like, I got laid off from my job in February. They just shut the department down that I was working in.
Oh, that sucks.
And yeah, well, it's worked out for me better than I think it normally does for a lot of people. And I'm very grateful. But I mean, I spent months, I applied to dozens and dozens of places and I got literally a single phone call back. And I would say probably 10 to 12 of those jobs, I ticked all of the requirements for, in terms of what they were looking for. And I'm like, that doesn't even rate a phone call. That doesn't even rate an email saying like, well, let's do a phone interview. And in the back of my head, I keep thinking about how everyone's like, oh, you have to keep your social media clean because, you know, HR and recruiters, they all look at your social media and they all look at the things that you're posting and the things that you put online about yourself. And I just think, holy shit, if the wrong person Googles my name as a recruiter, like, I'm done, mm-hmm. you know, and I will never know if that has actually happened because, you know, they would have to be a really weird confluence of circumstances. And I would have to know the right person that knows the right person that knows the right person to ever find out. But again, you know, with all that's going on in the world, I have to wonder, like, is that part of the reason why I'm not getting calls back?
Yeah, I end up wondering the same thing. And I'm currently looking for a new job. and have been for quite a while. And the last time I was doing a serious job search was, as well, where is it because I have a degree in theology?
Yeah.
Does that make people wonder either this person's going to be an angry atheist or a rabid evangelical? We don't want that.
Right. And then I think about, you know, I mean, I run a small business with my podcast, right? Mm-hmm. I know that means that I know marketing, I know promotion, I know, you know, community building and all of that stuff. And I think those are all really, really great skills to put on a resume. But the subject matter of my podcast makes me have to think twice about whether I put my podcast and the business that I've built on it on my resume. And I kind of err on the side of not doing it, depending on, you know, depending on where I'm applying. And so, yeah, it all just kind of like feels like I'm standing on one of those balance boards, like you see at the gym, right? Where I'm just mm-hmm. like working real hard to stay afloat. And I mean, I'm more fortunate than most in that I've been able to put a lot of time into building up the Patreon to the point where, between what my wife makes and between what I make on Patreon, we're kind of breaking even. And I can drive for Lyft 2 or 3 nights a week, and like bills are covered, and we've got, you know, maybe $50 or $60 to go out for dinner once or twice a month, you know, like for a date night or something like that. I wouldn't call it comfortable, but it works for now. Right. And that means like I'm in a far more fortunate position than a lot of other folks are. And so, you know, that's the other balance too, is sort of like recognizing the ways in which I am really, really, really fortunate and really, really privileged. But also owning the legitimacy of the kind of day-to-day fear that I have about, oh, you know, little things like the collapse of society and all of those fun things.
Or all of your civil rights getting rolled back.
Right, right. I mean, which is definitively happening, you know, because so many of them were, like I said, were put into place by executive order and aren't actually matters of law. And so, yeah, it's just a really scary time. Like, I was thinking about this the other day, when I was at Skepticon, and Rebecca Hensler, who started Grief Beyond Belief, mm-hmm. she did a workshop about dealing with grief over like our current political situation. And there was another workshop. I chose to go to a different workshop, but that's something that I've been kind of thinking about is, you know, even previous to all of this, as terrible as things were, I felt like we were at least inching slowly in the right direction.
Yeah.
And that comes with a certain mindset of like, I can have at least a little bit of faith that I can work my hardest at making things better. I can wake up tomorrow and we may have moved a millimeter in that direction, right? Mm-hmm. But we have definitively been moving backwards over the last 2 years. And that just creates a different frame of mind that it just kind of makes the day-to-day harder, if you know what I mean.
Well, I've definitely noticed it with the news we cover on the podcast is, and I was mm-hmm. thinking about this, just last week, where 2012 to 20, you know, mid 2016 for sure, it was, there was a fight for atheists to be not the, oh, what's the right word for it? Not getting shit on by society. Mm-hmm. And then it started being a lot more expanding that into, you know, gay people started getting a lot more civil rights. Courts were making rulings in favors of the LGBT community. Things were advancing. Gay marriage happened, and trans rights started to expand. And then 2016 happened, and since then it's been theocracy trying to force itself on the country. And I know it sucks, but as a straight white cis male who's married with a child, none of it seriously impacts me. Mm-hmm. You're in a different, very different situation. Theocracy definitely impacts you.
Yeah. And it's freaking scary. And that's honestly kind of something that I have struggled with. And part of the reason that I rebranded the podcast, not all of the reason, but part of the reason was that I was just like, I mean, is atheism really a thing that we really need to be talking about anymore? Like, why do I care? And like, that's a little bit more flippant than my attitude was, but for me, it was more very specifically like, yes, church state separation matters, but I am all the way over arguing over Christian apologetics in my life, you know?
Right.
And then, you know, you, you dig deep into what the right is trying to do, especially with things like Project Blitz. Like, the things that are seemingly little actually do matter. And that's something that I think that I was, I'd kind of gotten to a place where, like, I look back now and I think I was wrong about how little importance things like that carried. Cause you know, like FFRF is like filing one of their lawsuits about In God We Trust. And I'm just like, I mean, cool, do whatever, but like, why do I care? But now, like, I really do think that those things are very, very important because they are very definitively trying to lay the foundation for theocracy and, normalizing those kinds of things. And if you had asked me that before, I wouldn't say like, oh no, that's not really what's happening. I would have just been like, ah, the not really going to be that much of a priority for me, I don't think. And I think I was wrong to think that way. Seeing the way things are going down now, I think those things are very much important and kind of need to be at the forefront of what we're thinking about.
And now for the real reason why I was specifically wanting to have you on the show is, and before I start this, I do need to state that the views and opinions expressed on this podcast do not reflect the views of my employer or constitute any kind of, well, any bullshit from them. So now under the corporate, social media policy, I am covered and can say whatever the hell I want. I read that policy thoroughly and I do not speak for them and I don't name who they are, but it's usually pretty obvious if you do a little digging. But at work, we are going through a change in the, eventually it'll be all of the health systems, all the electronic, medical record and related systems. Working in the lab, we're going to be last with getting our lab systems switched over, but the main hospital electronic health record will be changing over next year. Mm-hmm. And it is a massive project that is, you know, it's huge across a very large health system. And it is a change to Epic, which is quickly becoming kind of the de facto standard for hospital information systems.
Yeah, I remember my ex, the hospital that she worked at, switched over to Epic, and it was like, it was a whole big thing. Like, she had to go in for like a week-long training and everything about it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I'm pretty sure my job will be eliminated when this is all finished, but it is a huge transition. Oh, well, one of the things they're doing is they're, at the same time, they're also switching from being a holding company to a actual management company. So the what used to be kind of the self contained regional organizations are just going to be regions in a large national corporation. So part of Epic is getting everybody switched onto a common platform that can all be managed out of headquarters. And headquarters is not in Boise, where I live.
Right.
And so one of the things that has come up is Epic has a lot more modern features in it than a lot of the legacy systems that are starting to get that it's replacing. And one that came up recently at work was questions around how it handles sex and gender, which is a lot different than how most systems I've worked with do. Like in my current laboratory information system, the three options are male, female, and unknown. And Epic has, you can put in sex assigned at birth. There's, current identity, there's something about legal status, there's a whole bunch of different questions on sex and gender to provide a lot of information so that in your medical record, there's enough information for the medical provider to look at it and be able to have a better chance of correctly interpreting lab results or not being surprised when doing a surgery. That kind of makes sense.
Yeah, I think so.
But it did also bring up some confusion with how we're going to be interacting with that in our current system, which has male, female, and unknown, is if somebody is trans, what reference ranges apply? And when I got asked that question by my supervisor, I was like, I have no idea. It seems like actually a really good question, but I don't know.
I have a lot of thoughts about this, all coming prefaced with the idea that, like, I have zero actual medical expertise. Mm-hmm. I have somewhat of a passing familiarity with this kind of stuff. So, like, my strong opinions really are more about like how healthcare providers and people interact with trans folks based on the information that is in these systems. But like, for example, one of the things that's often put forward is like the reason why the male-female distinction matters and why, like, for someone like me who was assigned male at birth, why that information matters is, for one example, that folks who are assigned male at birth and folks who are assigned female at birth metabolize differently. Mm-hmm. And so like when you're figuring out like medication dosages and stuff, that information matters.
Opiates are a big one on that.
Yeah. And so, you know, I would just have questions for a medical provider on that. Like how much of that's hormonal? So does the way that I metabolize medication become more in range with an assigned female at birth person once I'm on hormones for a certain period of time or after I've had surgery? I don't know. I mean, I know hormones do definitely cause metabolism changes. Like I can attest to that. I gained 60 pounds when I started hormones, you know, without really changing any of my eating habits or anything like that. So like, I know there are changes. And so, you know, if those changes do bring trans folks more in line with someone who is, you know, who is assigned one thing or another at birth, then I don't know why that information would matter in that case. Right.
Right.
I can think of, you know, surprises in surgery. I could think of sometimes where that would apply and where it wouldn't. I know, for example, when I had my weight loss surgery, they put a catheter in after I was under, and this was before I had had bottom surgery. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and I just, the thought hadn't occurred to me that I would have a catheter in for a day or two afterwards. And so I never mentioned anything, but like all of my paperwork says female. And I remember when I woke up and I thought this was very like sensitively and competently handled. But like the operating room nurse told the recovery room nurse, like, hey, just so you know, Callie here is trans and, you know, she has a penis. So, you know, we put the catheter in, we figured that out. So like, not a big deal. Just wanted to make sure you knew in case anything comes up with that. And I was like, cool. Like that seems like a very reasonable way to communicate that information. It's just, you know, the issues like with metabolizing medications, for example, like that kind of stuff makes sense to me.
Right. Because like if you've, it's a trauma situation and they're doing, having to do an exploratory surgery to find a bullet, if they're operating on a man and find ovaries, that shouldn't be more than a passing, wait, what?
Right, right.
And they're like, okay, yeah, there's ovaries here, there's a uterus here. Okay, let's keep going.
Right.
Because that's not the point of the surgery. At that point, the point is to find the bullets and get them out.
Right. And so like, you know, if a system like Epic, if it can distinguish like, you know, sex assigned at birth versus how this person actually identifies and who this person is, I actually think that's a great thing. Because with the little passing medical knowledge I have, like I can think of sometimes where it would be relevant, especially, you know, if we're talking about like recent surgical history, like if I, you know, I'm 2 months after bottom surgery, if I have to go to the emergency room for something separate, I probably still have pain meds in my system. And so like them knowing my surgical history would be a relevant thing, right? Like I would have to tell them like, yes, I had vaginoplasty, and I, you know, had XX drugs and I'm like still on these, you know, anti-nausea medications and so on. And like, you know, I stopped my opioids a week ago, so they're probably still somewhat in my system. You know, I can think of reasons why that is relevant. What I'm curious about is if there's, is there a space for like legal name versus chosen name? Is there a distinguishment for that? Do you know?
That I don't know yet. Considering that my department is going to be the last to switch over, I have seen the application once.
Gotcha.
And not been able to dig into it very much or had any training on it.
Gotcha, gotcha.
So I don't know yet.
Because, I mean, I think really the, you know, the two most important things in terms of trans folks interacting with the healthcare system, like, you know, I wouldn't say that I trust the medical system to get stuff right with the medical part, because I've personally experienced times where that's gone otherwise. But I don't know that I'd be able to to express a super strong opinion other than like what I've kind of talked about with like, you know, is it really medically relevant? Would be like a place where you can put in someone's pronouns and you can put in like the name that you should call someone if it doesn't match their legal name. Mm-hmm. Cause I can understand why a hospital would need your legal name. So, you know, they can connect the dots with who you are in other areas of life. If they need insurance. To do like emergency contact insurance. Right.
Yeah.
Like that sucks, but I get it. Like I don't think it's necessarily wrong of them to want to know what your legal name is. But like, you know, for example, the doctor that I go to, there's a space for legal name and preferred name.
Mm-hmm.
The word preferred is squicky to me. I would choose a different word, but that's not the end of the world. But that's basically so like if I'm sitting in the waiting room as a trans person and I haven't had the money or the time to get my name legally changed yet, and I'm, you know, dressed, painted nails, long hair, whatever, and somebody comes out and calls me Tim, you know what I mean? Like that causes a really uncomfortable situation.
Right.
And so, you know, having a space for that, and you know, someone's pronouns and stuff, I think that's really the more important thing, at least in my mind, as a person who's had some mild to moderately uncomfortable interactions with the healthcare system.
Now, I know my employer does have a policy that in any interactions with anybody, whether it's a colleague or a patient, you have to use preferred names. And that is the term they use.
Cool.
Which would also apply to my coworker, who we all call Katie, not Catherine.
Right. Exactly. Yeah.
We all call her Katie because she wants to be called Katie. So we call her Katie.
Yeah, that absolutely.
Fits with policy. Mm-hmm. If we were to try to not do that, we would actually be in violation of policy, which would be no different than somebody whose legal name is, you know, Tim and is going by Tammy now.
Right. Yeah. And I think that's wonderful. I think, I mean, it's cool to see a policy like that applied in favor of trans folks, right? It's really cool to see that like, well, yeah, it's obvious that like, if your name is James, but you really want to be called Jim, of course, that's what we should call you.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Just like if, you know, legally I'm Tim, but I want you to call me Sandra. Like, that's just what you got to do. Like, I think that's wonderful.
Yeah. And it's a no brainer. To me, at least it seems like a no brainer.
It really, really should be.
You know, and it would seem like in the medical setting, especially, you know, it's one thing with the outpatient clinic where you're going to your doctor who knows your situation well and is actively involved in your treatment and care. You would hope that there's a really good relationship that forms there and clear communication and everybody's comfortable. Otherwise, you'd be finding a different doctor, right?
Mm-hmm.
But when you need to go to the hospital, you don't get to pick necessarily.
Yep.
It might be the ambulance just takes you where it takes you.
Or if you're someone who's poor and has very little access and you go to the free clinic and there's rotating staff that never do get to know you. I think it's really important for situations like that too.
Right. And the trans community is disproportionately homeless, basically disproportionately screwed over in every sense, right?
I was going to say, yeah, disproportionately everything bad.
Yeah.
And even worse if you're black or brown.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, black trans woman is like the most fucked out of all of society, right? Basically,
at least in the United States, I can't speak for demographics in other parts of the world, but right, in the United States, the absolute worst thing to be basically is a black trans woman, in terms of like the bad things that you can expect your society to do to you. Yeah,
wow. So in the healthcare setting, that's when you're the most vulnerable. It's the most urgent and. There is definite, really good evidence that how well you are treated as a person and how well you are humanized in the process does impact how well the care goes and how well you recover.
Oh, absolutely. Well, and it also, makes a difference in people accessing care in the first place. I'll share like an anecdote. There was one night where Celeste and I were hanging out. This was pretty close to the beginning of our relationship. I think we'd been dating for maybe 3, 4, 5 months at this point. And I went to the bathroom and there was blood in the toilet and I was losing my shit because that's a really scary thing to see, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so, of course, my first instinct should be like, Celeste, we need to get in the car and go. I need to go to the emergency room. But my first instinct was, oh my gosh, I have to get on the internet and figure out which hospitals in the area are trans friendly.
Yeah.
Because like I'd almost rather risk it than go and be treated horribly in that vulnerable situation, especially something that actually does involve my genitals, where I'm going to have somebody looking at that. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, that was my first reaction, was that I have to figure out where it's safe for me to go. I got a recommendation and I went to a place, and thankfully none of it was a big deal. They said that I probably passed a small stone or something like that, because I never had any problems again after that. So like it all turned out well, but you know, in addition to whatever is physically wrong with me, I'm also in a vulnerable, terrified state of mind, just because like, I don't know how this is going to go on a social level, because I've heard so many horrible stories mm-hmm. from people about, I mean, just like medical malpractice, but also just people saying mean things, saying super insensitive things, whether intentional or not, that just make the whole thing far more stressful than it would have been otherwise. And, you know, I mean, policies like the, you know, you have to use someone's preferred name, whether we're talking about Katie versus Catherine or Tim versus Sandra, like, you know, having policies like that in place is great. You know, on the back end, you know, that information, I'm not sure how, you know, how that information services that dynamic necessarily, aside from, you know, to hopefully send folks in with the idea that, you know, my doctor is going to have all of the information that's necessary, but nothing that's like medically irrelevant, because as right, a trans yeah. person, my body is a curiosity.
Uh-huh. Right. Yeah. Right. Like it makes sense if that information is necessary to determine how are you going to be metabolizing a particular medication. It would make sense to have that information to figure out whether or not your laboratory results match up with the reference range that was assigned to you.
Yeah.
Beyond that, unless they're actually needing to deal with your genitalia, in a lot of cases, it really shouldn't matter.
Yeah. Yeah. Or, I mean, you know, something having to do with your reproductive system of some kind or another.
Yeah.
But like, obviously, I mean, if you're, you know, emergency surgery is one thing, but I mean, if you're seeking care for something having to do with your reproductive system and you're trans, like there's no way you're not going to have had that conversation with your doctor, you know?
Right. Like, and we covered a story a couple months ago. It's something that actually happened, I think, in 2017, and the lawsuits finally made its way to district court in Northern California, where a trans man went to the local hospital, and where he was at in California, it was a Catholic hospital, and he got in, was given a pink gown, requested a different color gown, was told no, because you're getting a hysterectomy, you're in the women's health surgical ward, you have to have a pink gown.
Oh, really? Like that's the hill they're going to die on? A pink gown?
Yep. Then
Jesus
got in, started getting prepped for the surgery, got shaved, and then the doctor came in and said, sorry, the bishop said we can't treat you. We need you to leave.
Fucking God. Well, you know, it's stuff like that, and it's also just doctors who just don't know what the hell to do with us, even with the best of intentions. You know, I had a complication after my bottom surgery where I bled more than I should have. And I ended up taking an ambulance ride to the hospital. And I'm like, in my head, I'm thinking like, okay, I'm bleeding more than I should. That probably just means that like I popped a stitch or something like that. So like anyone who has a modicum of experience with like wounds of some kind should mm-hmm. be able to like navigate this. Right. And so I get to the ER and the ER doctor is like, well, I've never dealt with anything involving this kind of surgery before, so I'm going to be honest and tell you I'm not really sure what to look for or what to do here. So I'm going to have to call your surgeon or, you know, their on-call doctor to get some information before I can really do much. And so I'm thinking, like, I am not in rural Kentucky. I am in San Francisco. I am in a hospital that is two blocks from the surgery center where this surgery happens every day. And the ER doctor is telling me that he has never seen anyone who's had vaginoplasty before, doesn't know anything about it, and doesn't know what to do. Like, you know,
I actually believe that. I find that completely plausible.
In that specific circumstance, I find it so baffling. Like, if I'm here... if I'm here in Cincinnati where like there aren't, I mean, the closest surgeon to here, I think, is in Michigan, like 5 hours away. So like they're probably not seeing many recently post-op vaginoplasty patients in that hospital. Right. But I'm just thinking like, man, you are in San Francisco and you are two blocks from the surgery center where these things are done. Like, really? Like, that was just mind blowing to me. And then of course, like, and again, like, I'm not a doctor, right? So there might be considerations that this doctor was thinking about that I just don't have a concept for. So like, I want to give this person the benefit of the doubt. But I'm just thinking like, if bleeding is my problem, what do you need to know other than the fact that I was like cut open and have incisions and stitching and stuff? You know, maybe there is something, you know,
well,
what I mean?
Okay, for a good example, if a pregnant woman goes into an ER, they will almost always be sent to labor and delivery.
Yeah.
Even if it's for a broken leg. Labor and delivery doesn't know how to treat broken legs, but they know how to take care of pregnant women. ERs don't know how to take care of pregnant women.
Right.
If a woman postpartum were to go into the ER with bleeding, she would probably be sent to labor and delivery to get that taken care of. Because again, ERs don't take care of those bits. You add in, you have those bits that were stitched together by a doctor. An ER doc's not going to know what to do with that. It's not a broken leg. It's not a heart attack. Those are most of what they deal with.
Yeah, that's fair.
If you had something lost in your butt, most ER docs would be pretty good at handling that. But
right, right.
Literally butt adjacent, and that's outside butts of good, what they
butts
deal
adjacent.
With.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and I just, in, you know, in fairness to the doctor, by the time I got to the ER, the bleeding had actually stopped. And so I think at that point it was just like, well, you know, the immediate problem has been solved. And now like I need to know what to look for to make sure that there are no additional problems. And so, yeah, I mean, maybe that person deserves more of the benefit of the doubt that I'm giving them. But, you know, I had also just like lost like probably like a pint of blood, which is like in the grand scheme of things, not a lot, right?
Yeah. When that's your blood, it's terrifying.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And like not in the best state of mind, because I also like I had to pee so bad I was not able to think right, and they wouldn't let me because I had lost blood. They're like, we can't get you out of the bed until you can, you know, until we know like your blood counts are good, and because of all the swelling, the little urinal thing, I couldn't pee laying down. It was a nightmare. And so maybe I'm projecting the rest of the horror of that experience onto that one particular conversation. I am willing to give, I'm willing to give on that. But like other stuff, like I have a trans guy friend who went to see a doctor for a sinus infection and the doctor was like asking questions about his genitals. You know, things like that are just like baffling to me. And then like I went to the ER once for stomach pain and the nurse was like trying to ask me questions about trans stuff. Like, oh, you know, they gave us a training like 2 years ago and I wish they would do more of these things. Cause you know, I have lots of questions. And then like, she starts asking me questions and I'm like, you know, I had surgery on my stomach a year ago and now I'm experiencing some of the worst pain I've ever had in my life in that area of my body. Mm-hmm. And you're like here trying to have a conversation with me about trans stuff. Could we not maybe,
right.
You know,
yeah.
Like
I'm not relevant
scared out
to
of my
what
mind.
You're there for.
Yeah. Like scared out of my mind in potential serious danger. And you're like, oh, I've never really talked to a trans person before. Like, come on. And like, and I mean, you know, that particular story is kind of like mild in comparison to some of the other things that I've heard, like, cause that was just kind of annoying. And I think she took the hint and didn't continue. But, you know, honestly, that's kind of more like what I think about. Yeah.
But it's like, I've been to the ER with allergic reactions. I've never been asked to take off my pants or been asked any questions about what's in my pants.
Right.
I've been to urgent care and never been asked to take off my pants. Heck, I even had an infection on my leg, like it was on my thigh. And rather than have me take off my pants, he just wanted me to pull up my shorts a little bit further, make it as easy as possible. And no questions about what was inside of my pants. It wasn't relevant.
Yeah. And so, I mean, like I always err on the side of giving in, you know, the information that doctors want. It's just like real weird to be asked like, when was your last period? Well, I don't have those because I'm trans. Okay. We're going to do an x-ray. Have you had a pregnancy test lately? I'm trans. That's not a thing for me. you know, recent surgical history. Like, well, it was 2 years ago. I'm not sure how relevant that is, but like, you're a doctor and you're asking me, you know more than I do. So I'm going to give you that information. Mm-hmm. But like, it automatically outs me, and people get pushy, and I get why they get pushy, because, you know, I'm on the way back to, you know, to get an x-ray, because I had, sprained my wrist. And the x-ray tech is like, well, have you had a pregnancy test lately? And I was like, yeah, not necessary. And they're like, are you sure? And I was like, trust me, it's just not necessary. And they keep asking, right? Because we live in a litigious society, right?
Litigious society, but we live in a society where a lot of people don't get sex ed.
Right, right. Exactly.
There are a lot of stupid people who don't know they're pregnant.
Right. And I don't begrudge them like asking for that information, but I just like, I'm not an expert, but I just wonder if there's a better way to handle that, because in order to answer those questions to people's satisfaction, I have to out myself as trans in situations. So like me being trans, I would be shocked to find that me being trans has any relevance when I sprain my wrist. You know what I mean?
Right. Well, okay. Heck, even when it comes to laboratory reference ranges, it is very few tests where there are different ranges between male and female.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's several with the CBC. Complete blood count.
Mm-hmm.
There's definite differences in different hormone tests. And you would hope that, like in your case, that with a hormone test, your doctor knows what your target ranges are and is not going to just be looking at reference ranges.
Well, right. And especially they're going to ask what medications I'm taking, and I'm going to tell them my hormones because I take those every day. So like, obviously that's relevant. But I mean, that could also just be like a regular HRT dose that a postmenopausal cis woman takes. Mm-hmm. Or that, you know, a cis woman with some kind of hormone disorder takes. And so like, I don't necessarily have to out myself to answer those questions.
But I also do know that like with ERs, there's like I already mentioned, if a woman is pregnant at the ER, they ship them off to to labor and delivery. So they check every woman that goes into the ER to see if she's pregnant.
Yeah. Well, you know, and I think that just kind of demonstrates the importance of having trans folks in there. Like trans folks who are doctors, who are nurses, who are mm-hmm. medical professionals with that actual knowledge, writing the policy and looking at like, you know, if this is medically relevant, then absolutely I want it in there because I mean, that's my safety and that's my health. You know what I mean? It is just so hard for me to trust that if a trans person wasn't in that room, things that would out me as trans are relevant. You know what I mean? Whether intentional or unintentional.
Like a perfectly reasonable one would be if you answer on like last menstrual period or all right, let's do a pregnancy test. Having a valid option is being, I don't have a uterus.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Nothing to worry about then.
Yeah, absolutely. Cause I could just as easily be trans or have had a hysterectomy.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's a wonderful idea.
That provides sufficient information to answer the question and prove that you aren't just some stupid person who doesn't know how sex works.
Yep. Absolutely.
I even see it with, I touch pathology related stuff as little as absolutely possible. But I know with the women's health panels, that's something they've been pushing really hard in the last few years. A lot of them have questions about, and like the pap smear for sure. Mm-hmm. As last menstrual period, hysterectomy, yes or no. If yes on the hysterectomy, when was the date of the surgery?
Mm-hmm.
It's crazy the amount of information they want when doing that kind of a test to evaluate what would seem like, do you see evidence of cancer? Yes, no. But to the pathologist, having a lot more history is important to be able to fully interpret the data that is there.
Right. And I mean, the medical community has to kind of operate on averages, right? Like there have mm-hmm. to be models. And I get that. And often how we find out things are wrong is that we have a model of what usually happens. And if we see a person whose situation is abnormal in comparison to what we know to be normal, removing the moral connotation from normal, like, you know, what happens most of the time for most people is not what happens most of the time for this person. We have to have those models. And I get that. I just don't know that, you know, relatively speaking, like XX chromosome, XY chromosome is the most sensible way to do that. But I mean, you know, I say it over and over again, cause I'm trying not to like swerve out of my lane and like, cause I'm obviously not a doctor. But I just wonder, part of the problem seems to be that people with bodies who are radically different don't even factor into the model. There's often not really procedures or policies in place, and people just kind of like don't know what the hell to do when a trans person mm-hmm. shows up. And I think that's kind of more the problem to address, because, you know, there are a lot of things to which like the normal model is probably not going to apply to me. And I would just like the medical professionals I interact with to be prepared for that eventuality.
Right. To know well enough, like to not just be looking for colored results, mm-hmm. but to actually be interpreting the data and knowing your situation well enough to be able to actually interpret that data.
Yeah.
That would absolutely. Be nice. Mm-hmm. But I've actually been a part of a reference range study. Hospitals have to re-baseline periodically, and there aren't a lot of men working in the anywhere around the lab. So basically any man anywhere near the lab always gets looped in for every study, often bribed with candy.
So you're the model now.
So I am part of the normal reference range for the chemistry tests in Boise, Idaho.
It's a wonderful legacy to have, I think.
And what's interesting is you rule out anybody who isn't normal, and then you test them.
Yeah.
Only the normal people. So you identify who's normal, and then you test them to figure out what's normal.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and you know, knowing that sometimes those models don't apply right, because like there was you know, the time that I went, God, what time? When I thought there might be something wrong with my heart, I went to the ER, and they actually woke me up in the middle of the night because my heart rate dropped to like 40 beats per minute.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, right? Like real, real slow. And they just kind of woke up like, hey, are you feeling okay? And I was like, yeah. I mean, you just woke me up, so I'm a little annoyed, but I'm okay. What's going on? And they're like, yeah, your heart rate just dropped super, super low. And sometimes that's just normal for people, but we just wanted to make sure. And so like, obviously in that case, there's an awareness that what's normal for most people is not normal for all people. And so they mm-hmm. kind of just like check in like, hey, this is where your number's at. Is it normally on the low side? Yes, it is. Okay, cool. We can all move on from that. And so like, I would imagine or hope that we could apply that same concept to other things and like, just understand that like the model works in most cases, but not all cases. And to always like keep our minds on the idea that, you know, in any given case, we might be looking at one where the averages don't apply in one case or another for one reason or another.
And that would be one case where having more information on the front end is helpful in figuring out that if something doesn't quite fit the normal range on whatever it is, if something's atypical, that might actually be normal in this person's situation.
Yeah. And for me, I think it goes back to my weight loss, because I was always in like a normal adult range before that. And after I lost weight, and especially after I started playing roller derby, like my heart just beats slower than the average person, and it's fine. It's also probably why I'm cold all the time, so I'm a little mad about it, but.
Oh man. And, so would it also be fair to say that trans people have greater healthcare needs than the average person?
If we're speaking in generalities, I don't know. It's hard to say. Because I don't really know what the numbers are when it comes to like how many trans folks do go on HRT, you know, versus folks who don't want or need it, or people who can't access it for one reason or another. And so I can say like most trans folks I know and my experience at least have hormones. And so that means there's mm-hmm. like, you know, in the case of trans mask folks, you know, there's like maybe a weekly injection of testosterone, for most trans women, you know, a couple of pills per day, maybe a patch or something like that. But I feel like it's pretty usual to have like, you know, one or two medications that you take on a regular basis.
And probably seeing the doctor regularly and monitoring of your levels.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. Although increasingly, thankfully, primary care doctors are also like able to take care of that sort of thing, which is really nice.
Oh, nice.
At least in my experience, obviously, I don't want to like you know, the people I know in my city, I don't want to like map their experience to everyone else, but there does seem to be an increasing number of folks who are able to access that kind of thing. And then as far as like transition related care, you know, things other than hormones, generally speaking, are just like one-time surgeries that you recover from and just kind of like move on from.
Right.
And, you know, I would say, you know, having one or two surgeries is not super atypical for the average person.
All right. Yeah.
And you know, trans-related surgery kind of falls in that. It's not an emergency surgery like, you know, I had a heart attack kind of surgery. But it's also not elective in the fact of like, you know, I just don't like how big my boobs are, so I'm going to get bigger boobs. You know, it is a like something that I think is a necessity, but it's something that, you know, to one degree or another, you can choose the time of, and it's not something that has to happen like tomorrow or it's going to be a major problem.
Important, not urgent.
Yeah. I'd say, yeah. And so, you know, I don't really know that I would say, I would say that often trans folks' specific needs can be unique, but I don't know if there are more of those needs or more of an interaction necessarily. You know, aside from maybe like, you know, if we're going on the idea that most trans folks are seeking out hormone treatments, then, you know, worst case, that means you have an endocrinologist in addition to your primary care doctor.
But there's a lot of people who have endocrinologists.
Yeah, exactly. Well, my primary care doctor is also an endocrinologist, and he actually coded my hormone prescription as an unspecified hormone disorder. So he's like, you know, whatever insurance you get will cover your meds because of the diagnosis.
Yep.
And so, I mean, there's all kinds of hormone disorders that people need to see endocrinologists for. I mean, I would say maybe the specific needs that trans folks have can be unique, not necessarily so. But I don't actually know that I would say that we necessarily have more interaction than the average person with the medical system.
Well, if you consider the number of cis women on some kind of a birth control.
Yeah.
Add in diabetes medications, cholesterol medication, blood pressure medications, and antidepressants. Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if trans people just would kind of disappear into the averages.
Yeah, I was going to say, I would imagine we probably, generally speaking, would fall pretty close to the same curve as the average population. Maybe you know, maybe a little bit higher for you know, meds for like depression and anxiety. Because we know like the society that we live in causes us to experience that at disproportionate rates.
Right. Okay.
But yeah, I can't really necessarily see anything that I would think that there would be like a huge thing that stands out as different from the average the average person aside from that.
And would you say that generally speaking, and just from your own experience, when you've gone to hospitals or needed something outside of your primary care situation, have you felt like you were treated well, or have you had situations where you felt like you were actually discriminated against or just mistreated in some way?
I wouldn't say that I've ever been outright mistreated, thankfully. There have definitely been some moments that made me uncomfortable, like that nurse that was like asking me trans questions when I'm in the middle of a crisis thinking there might be something wrong with my digestive system. But like, I mean, that didn't interfere with her care of me, right? Because I think she was just there to draw blood or something like that. And I mean, she was doing all of the things she was supposed to be doing while we were talking. And so like, it made me a little uncomfortable. I didn't think it was exactly appropriate, but I didn't feel like I was like, I wouldn't go as far to say as it was like mistreatment. And then the other stuff is just sort of like the aggressive questions about like the last time you had a period and pregnancy test, which again, like I don't begrudge those folks asking those questions. I don't think that like those people are attacking me personally. I just lament the circumstances that makes it necessary, and it made me uncomfortable. I wouldn't call that like an egregious like violation of my rights or anything like that. Thankfully, my interactions have been almost entirely positive. The one glaring thing was a paperwork screw up that had nothing to do with me being trans. It just had to do with my surgeon's office being terrible at paperwork. Yeah.
All right. And other trans people you talk to, would you say that's relatively typical of an experience?
there is a very strong divide between people who have health insurance and people who don't. People who have like employer sponsored healthcare, like through either them or their spouse, or people who are on like Medicaid, because low income folks don't really have a choice of where to go most of the time. And so, you know, they have to do a lot of time figuring out like where they have access to go and who they have access to. And a lot of times they end up in some really uncomfortable situations, especially with mental health care providers. With like primary care doctors and stuff like that. In the area that I'm in, there is a pretty strong group of folks that are pretty trans competent, as far as like primary care doctors for like physical health.
Mm-hmm.
But finding competent mental health care can be pretty difficult. Generally my experience is that people with like employer sponsored health care, like quality insurance, their interactions with the medical system generally better than lower income folks who don't have that kind of thing. There's a very, very strong divide between those two.
All right. And I'm sure that that would apply to cis people as well.
Yeah. Oh yeah, for sure.
You get better experiences when you have good insurance.
Yeah. I would just, so for me, my interactions mostly have just been more that like, people just kind of like, oh gosh, I've never met a trans person before. I don't really know how to do this. But like, they're generally like they're not like hostile. But some of the lower income folks that I know have definitely run into situations where people were being outright hostile, like refusing to use their correct pronouns, refusing to use the correct name and all of that sort of stuff. You know, because it's on the form, you know, that kind of thing. And so I would say that there probably is a unique experience in that specific situation, right? with people like being actively hostile.
Right. You aren't likely to run into a church member who's there as part of some kind of a mission outreach thing. If you're paying.
Yeah. 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 Right.
Yeah. Free clinic. That's a little different. That can be different.
Mm-hmm.
Now let's talk about your podcast. Cause last time you were on the show, you were hosting the Gaytheist Manifesto, mm-hmm. and now you're host of Queersplaining.
Indeed.
What's the difference between the two?
So there's a couple of things. I really just stopped being interested by speaking about atheism related things specifically. And not because I don't think it's an important conversation to be had. I just don't know that I was the best person or the most interested person to continue having that specific conversation. The other big thing really is the format of the show changed pretty radically. I pride myself on remaining a student of my art at all times in podcasting. And I do very much think of podcasting as an art.
Mm-hmm.
And I was doing a lot of research into formats and like different things that podcasts can be other than just like a straight up interview show. And the idea of doing things that are more focused on storytelling was super appealing to me. And I, for a little bit, started a second show. I called it The Queer Side. And I did more like straight up NPR style storytelling with folks,
mm-hmm.
Not really specifically about religion or atheism or anything like that. Although one of the episodes was about someone who grew up bisexual and Christian, and you know the different things that came out of that. And I really really enjoyed making those. Like it's so much more work to make a show like that, but it was just so much more fun for me. And it was one of those things where like I could go back and I could listen to it over and over and over again and be like, man, this is so freaking cool that I made this. And making a second podcast turned out to be too much work. And so like I stuck with doing Gaytheist Manifesto because it was actually a source of income for me. And it's not that I didn't like doing it. I just kind of liked doing the other thing better, you know?
Right. But you don't have the 5 or 6 producers and 10 audio right. engineers and everything else that an NPR show has.
Absolutely. And God, the more and more I learn about how much work goes into a 15-minute segment on This American Life, it's disgusting. Like it would take me 3 months to do that on my own.
And you don't have a staff of 20. You are you.
Right. Exactly. And so I stopped doing that for a little bit, but I was definitely kind of feeling the weight of, I haven't really talked about religion or atheism in forever, so I don't know that the name of the show fits. And I'm doing a pretty radically different kind of show because I started skewing more towards that kind of storytelling on the Gaytheist Manifesto. And I figured out some ways to streamline it a little bit to where it didn't take quite so long to make an episode. And you know, it weighed on me a lot. I talked to a whole bunch of people about it. I sought out tons of advice from other people. And so at the end of last year, I decided that I was going to do it. And I made one last episode I'd made 4 or 5 episodes that were like the completely like radically redesigned format. And then I was like, you know what, I'm going to take, I think I took like a 2-week break, at the beginning of January of this year. And I came back with the name Queersplaining. And that was, I wish I had a cool story, but that name literally just popped into my head as I was driving home from work one night. As I was driving home and I was like mulling over, I'd kind of decided like, yeah, you know what? I think I do want to do a rebrand, but I have no idea what the hell I'm going to call this thing. And I had like had some conversations with other podcasters that I respect and like kind of bouncing ideas off of them. And a lot of the names that I thought of were pretty terrible. And I was just driving home from work and I was like, oh my God, Queersplaining. That's it. That's what it's going to be. And so I came back with that and I'm still playing with the format a little bit. I like storytelling to always be at the heart of it. Mm-hmm. And so at first it was very much a hard turn towards that NPR style storytelling, aided by the fact that I got laid off from my day job in February. So I had a lot more time to put into each episode.
Yeah.
And they did us okay in terms of severance. So I was not desperate to immediately go get another job. And I just really enjoyed making shows that way. And then I started to get feedback that folks missed my voice in the show, which I mean, I appreciated hearing. It was cool to hear that like people missed me. And so I kind of put a little bit more of myself back into the show and made it slightly more of a conversation than a like straight up like narrated or non-narrated like NPR storytelling piece. And kind of what I've come down to now is, you know, I'll do an interview, I'll talk to somebody for an hour, hour and a half, 2 hours, and it'll end up being a 20, 30, maybe 40 minute at the most interview. And so I'm just like really, really heavily, tightly editing for narrative, only making sure that like the best bits get in there. And so like a more highly polished, very focused, tightly edited, narrative driven sort of interview show. And just focusing on telling stories about the lives of queer and trans folks or like issues that affect the way we navigate the world, often like through the lens of a person for whom that story is relevant. So like I did an episode about the trans military ban, and I was able to get connected with a JAG officer in the Army who is trans. And so nice. And so she was like the expert on the situation in several ways.
Oh, yeah.
And so like I had her educating me on what was going on, but also like what that meant for the people involved. And so that's kind of where I'm at now. I'm just kind of trying to give like a real like window into the lives of queer and trans folks that, kind of the problem that I was trying to solve is that when you hear a mainstream media piece about a queer or a trans person, it's almost entirely focused on their queerness or on their transness. And it's usually some kind of a coming out story or like how I learned to love myself or like how I learned to love my trans kid, despite how much of a nightmare they've made my life kind of story.
Right.
Feeling very, very like objectifying and fetishistic, kind of like a zoo exhibit. Like, you know, you have a tour guide like, well, you know, this is the bisexual enclosure. This is the pansexual enclosure. This is the transgender enclosure, as opposed to like actually getting a portrait of what the lived experiences of these folks are like. And so,
you know, I hope being you didn't feel like that's what this was.
No, not at all. I actually made a pretty, specific decision a while ago to not engage in those kinds of things. And here's the thing. I also am not entirely dismissing the value of those things, because coming out stories are important, right? Mm-hmm. Like learning how to come to terms with who you are, that stuff is really important. The problem for me is not that those things exist. The problem for me is that often that feels like the only thing that exists.
Right.
And so, I mean, I'll tell my coming out story on 12 different podcasts, you know, all day long, not a big deal. And if I felt like objectified or fed, like I am over giving a fuck about being polite about any of that. So no, if I felt like that, you would know, trust me.
All right, because
not a big deal.
Yeah, I was definitely have been viewing this as I have some questions about trans experience, and you're my go-to expert on trans issues.
Yeah, and I'm here for it. I'm awesome. Absolutely here for it. Yeah.
Cool.
And so that's my super, super long explanation of why I rebranded the show and what my current philosophy is.
All right. Well, where can people find you?
Queersplaining.com. I'm at Callie Gets It on Twitter and Instagram, and at queersplaining_ on Instagram is the show's Instagram, because somebody took the at queersplaining handle, used it for like 2 weeks and hasn't posted in years.
Oh,
jerks.
Damn.
Yeah. So mad about it. Branding, the branding part of my brain is so mad that I don't have the same username across all platforms. But it's fine. I'll live.
But you like the name enough to not pick a different name.
I'm going to be honest. I did not check Instagram before I made the choice to switch, because I've only recently become an Instagram user. I just like, am I good on Facebook and Twitter? I am. Cool. So, you know, that's a hole I dug for myself, and I'll learn to live with it.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Callie. It's been a real pleasure.
Absolutely, my friend. Thanks for having me.
I do have some feedback I want to cover. Some of this is actually a few weeks old that I missed, and I want to apologize about that. So from Colleen via Twitter, at C Rose J, at DW Nomad, that's my personal Twitter account from back in the blogging days. Listening to the most recent episode now, I'm sorry that your only true experience of Michigan was around Berrien Springs. It's definitely one of the more boring parts of the entire state. And I did get to see a little bit more than just Berrien Springs. I got to go up north a couple hours for Thanksgiving and did the historical Adventist Village tour in Battle Creek. And I also did a similar patrol search and rescue exercise about 2 hours east of Berrien Springs. So I did get out a little bit, but it's a big state and I didn't get all that far out of it. I also got to see the tarmac of the Detroit airport when my return flight from Jordan got turned around because of thunderstorms and tornadoes at the O'Hare airport, and we were running out of fuel. So they diverted us after about an hour in a holding pattern over Western Michigan. They rerouted us to Detroit to land and get fuel. But since we hadn't been cleared through customs, we were not allowed off the airplane. And in mid-July, when they have to turn off the AC and all the fans to refuel, and it's 5 o'clock p.m. in Detroit, oh, that sucked. And then from Wild B via Discord, your podcasts have been keeping me sane. Keep up the good work. Thanks, Wild B. I'm glad to know that the show makes a difference. From Celia via Facebook, sorry to hear Aaron is no longer co-hosting the show, but I was delighted to hear little Kylie in the microphone. Oh, and I love Sarah Silverman even more now. Screw that hate-filled preacher who attacked her with his Nazi rhetoric. Amen, sister. That's it for this week. Remember, not all those who wander are lost. Thank you for listening to another episode of Atheist Nomads. You can find show notes and contact information at atheistnomads.com. Follow us on Twitter at Atheist Nomads, and like us on Facebook at facebook.com/atheistnomads. Please subscribe to the show in iTunes, Stitcher, or your podcatcher of choice. And while you're there, feel free to leave us a review. Theme music is courtesy of Sturdy Fred. Until next time, this has been the Atheist Nomads.